Part two is what friendship is. So there are almost as many mistakes about friendship as there are about happiness. Friendships in the United States today tend to be vitiated by relativism and by what Pope Francis calls the throwaway culture. Okay. Relativism is the standard pop cultural way of people dealing with one another. It's so much a part of our culture that we don't even recognize it. And this is why it's widespread. To disagree is, to that extent, disagreeable. That's where the word disagreeable comes from. Now, disagreement in a relationship is sustainable if there are deeper principles of agreement, or there's a broader context in which one can have confidence the disagreement is going to work out, or it's going to shrink in proportion, it's not going to appear to be that large. But lacking these, which is typically the case in our superficial relationships, it's easier to deal with disagreement by making it go away, by converting it into agreement. And the way it gets converted into agreement is through relativism. So you have a couple of friends together, and they somehow stumble upon, let's say, the topic of abortion, and it's clear that they don't think the same way about it. And they can kind of, you know, warily go around it for a little bit, but very quickly, typically, they'll come upon the expedient, well, it's wrong for me, but it's perhaps okay for you. Or we're both personally opposed to it. Right. Personally opposed, you could have two people or 10 people in a room all personally opposed to something, but they're actually not agreeing on it. Because if the other person weren't personally opposed, there'd be no conflict, so they can't be agreeing. So relativism is like a magic pill. It's an easy way of getting rid of disagreement. Now the problem with it is it converts friendship into flattery. A friend tells the truth and speaks the truth even if it's not pleasant. The flatterer says what's pleasant to hear, even if it's not true. Contrast with this Plato's concept of true, genuine dialogue. So a genuine dialogue is when each friend recognizes that a false opinion is a harm, it's an evil. It's like an illness or deficiency of some sort. And if it were discovered that you had a false opinion, you'd want to reject it. And if it were discovered that your friend had a false opinion, you'd like to take it away from him. So a genuine dialogue is two friends getting together to refute and be refuted in turn, Plato says. Right. Refute me, please. Now, I think one of the reasons why we don't do this in our culture is that we don't have training in civil conversation that reaches all the way back to the universities. It is a skill. You have to acquire this. It's not something that just comes automatically or naturally. Okay, what about the throwaway culture? Well, the throwaway culture encourages us to think of friends as persons who fit in and help us. And if they don't fit in and they're not helping us, then they get thrown away, depending on the circumstances. Now, I think this is very much like finding time for prayer. Right. You know, and you found it out from your own experience, that if prayer is what you do when you've taken care of everything else, then you never pray. Right. It indicates that you don't put sufficient value on prayer. Right. And I think as a kind of divine punishment, then we never get around to doing it anyway. Right. Now, I remember in college when I was so busy with my studies and extracurriculars, I'd meet with a friend, and we have these, back then, these paper appointment books, and we'd say, okay, we got to get together. I haven't seen you in so long. Let's really get together. Free here? No. All right, well, next time we'll find a time to get together. We just couldn't even get together. Right? Not even by making an appointment to get together. Contrast these two lifestyles. Somebody who moves from city to city, as in the United States, makes friends while they're at that city, goes on to another city, kind of forgets the old friends, who maybe Facebook connections or something like that, makes new friends, goes on to another city. Right? In contrast, somebody who doesn't take a job in a new city, even though it might mean a pay raise, and I'm not saying this is right or wrong, I'm saying just draw the contrast, because he wants to remain with his friends, right? Which is almost unheard of in our society, right? I was speaking with somebody about this the other day, about the kind of two different cultures, the kind of Mexican culture and American culture. Mexican culture is you stay with your friends and waste time. American culture is if you have time, you might, you know, looking at your clock, spend time with your friends. All right, well, that's the throwaway culture, and we're all battling against it, I think. Now, you've heard famously that Aristotle said that there are three forms of friendship, for pleasure, for utility, and for, let's say, for goodness. That's not really his term, but we'll say that, for pleasure, for utility, for goodness. Right? And these pleasure and utility friendships can seem kind of unreal, like pleasure friendships or, you know, wild parties. Right? Utility friendships are networking, right, to make money off of somebody. Maybe booking every 6 minutes that you're spending with somebody. But the two we've just mentioned fall into those categories. The relativistic friendship is a pleasure friendship. Throwaway culture friendship is a useful friendship in Aristotle's notion. The monikers of pleasure and utility for him are simply the highest level descriptions that you're giving of the value, the character of the value that's motivating and that's central to that relationship. Now, what about this ideal form of friendship, genuine friendship? I think Aristotle, Augustine, Cicero, they're all talking about the same thing, right? And they spent a lot of time writing about it. I think Bill mentioned this in the introduction. We don't, in contrast, because they valued a lot more. Right? They thought finding a genuine friend was almost what necessary to make life worth living. By the way, I think we see this in our children so more easily than others, and I think it's important that we see this and they see that we see this. Like, we look in the eyes of one of our children and we realize life is valuable just to have this child. Just to be with this child, that itself is what life would be worthy of. So in this ideal kind of friendship, central friendship, genuine friendship, it itself has an ideal. The friend is another self. That's the old saying. Right? And it's kind of an unrealistic, almost impossible achievement, the friend is another self. Right? Their extreme realization would be if you die for someone, take their place. And then you count the fact that they continue to live your life. So you're letting that person be another self. It has to be based on attraction to the goodness of the other person, either natural, which occurs within families, because especially we're dealing, say, with young children before the age of reason, it's their natural goodness. So St. Jose Maria calling them the new ones. Right? They're kind of like directly from the press. God has just pressed them out, right? And we see God so clearly in the young children, right? Natural goodness, or acquired goodness. Likeness is central to friendship. There has to be some basis of likeness. Complementary strengths are typically present, but they get assimilated. So likeness is both, as St. Thomas Aquinas says, a cause and effect of friendship. So one effect of friendship is that you recognize the strengths your friend has, which you don't have. And that becomes another basis for friendship because it's a kind of likeness. It's a likeness through end, through purpose, through striving. You want to become like your friend. By the way, this is the difference between the complementarity of male and female and the complementarity of friends. The complementary strengths of friends, each friend wants to acquire for himself. Right, so I wrote this accounting ethics textbook with a friend who was a forensic accountant. At the time, I knew nothing about accounting and almost nothing about business, and I was kind of simply an abstract philosopher, and I was attracted to his business knowledge, and I learned about accounting. I studied textbooks on accounting and acquired some of that knowledge, not the same amount, of course, but there was some kind of equalization where we became more alike. Right? Complementarity of the sexes is not like that. So I'll hold up my arm against my wife's, and it'll really look like we're two species. The hand is so small, and the arm's so thin, and right, and I marvel at that, right? And it's attractive. right? That it's so delicate and strange, just needing to be protected, so to speak. And yet I don't want to have a thin arm like that. I want it to stay that way. In fact, I've been playing tennis every morning. I don't know if you noticed that. I'm getting like Rod Laver. This side is huge. It's doctors out there, this is not an illness. It's just I'm playing tennis a lot. In this genuine friendship, Aristotle speaks of wishing goods to others, but really what that means is sacrifices. You make sacrifices for the other person, and free gifts and sacrifices. He says its characteristic mark is spending time together. Right? He uses two words for this. One is living together, and the other is actually a Greek word which means spending your days with someone. And if you're not wanting to spend your days with someone, then you don't really want to be their friend. Right? It's not quality time, it's time. Right, there's this spiritual author, is it Jacques Philippe, isn't that his name, who's very much liked in the work, I think, for good reason. He says, if you want to become holy, get used to wasting time. So he says. Aristotle says the genuine form of friendship is perfect, complete, in the sense that it combines within it all three grounds on which you could be drawn to someone: goodness, utility, and pleasure. So we spoke of as effective goodness that comes into play in friendship. Right? Pleasure, not the pleasure of entertainment, not the pleasure of flattery, but genuine human pleasures, like maybe going out, will this shock anybody? Going out hunting together, say. Or being outside playing sport together. That kind of pleasure. Wholesome pleasures, one would say, right? Not artificial pleasures. And these flow from the goodness of the friend's natural required. As an ideal, friendship involves a complete unity of affection, intention, and will. That's Cicero's formula. Sincerity, the unburdening of one's heart, it's something I think we need to teach our children, is that you don't unburden your heart. Right? St. Josemaria says the heart is locked with seven locks. Right? You unburden your heart to your confessor, your spouse, and to a good friend, and then that's it. You don't unburden your heart beyond that. And yet, a friend is someone to whom you can unburden your heart. That's a great good. The ability to speak freely. Paresia is the Greek term. To say what you really think, not to have to guard your words. Also, to be confident that what you say is not going to be repeated without your permission. This idea of discretion is central to friendship. It's deeply rooted in one's character and takes time to develop. So a genuine friend is someone who becomes a part of you. You are what you are because of your relationship to this friend, in part, and vice versa. All right, so that's kind of a description of genuine friendship, what we're talking about, and it is a kind of ideal, and we can approach it or fall away from it in different degrees. That's the second part.